Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me today. My special guest today is Atlantic contributing writer David Frum. We are in the midst of a war with Iran, in which our only ally is Israel. And I think it's fair to say that however this turns out, it is raising the stakes for the Jewish people around the world because of this alliance, and what it will mean, we are not sure. But to probe this and other matters, I asked David to join me to discuss a number of things that viewers seem to struggle with. So, David, first of all, thank you so much for being here. Let's begin with distinguishing between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. There are so many people who say, of course, I oppose anti-Semitism with every fiber of my being. That's a sin, and so on. But to criticize Israel doesn't make me an anti-Semite. So you can be an anti-Zionist without being an anti-Semite. So let's talk about that. Because I do think it's true that you can criticize Israel without being an anti-Semite, and yet it bleeds into anti-Semitism in so many instances, right?
Well, a way I find helpful to think about this is to think, where did the word anti-Semitism come from, and why was it invented? The term was coined in the late 19th century in the German-speaking lands by secular bigots who wanted to say, you know, in the olden days, Christians hated Jews for not being Christian and objected to Jews being particular and standoffish and not joining the religion of the majority, having their own ways in their own places. But, said the anti-Semites of the 19th century, the problem with those Christian anti-Jewish people, or those Jew haters of yore, was they didn't understand that Judaism is a biological, not a religious category. And they left it possible, if a Jew converted to Christianity, that they could escape the hatred that they were due. Whereas the anti-Semite said, it doesn't matter whether a Jew converts to Christianity, doesn't matter what a Jew thinks, doesn't matter what a Jew does. All that matters is the biological character of the Jew. And that, of course, is the attitude that led into the Holocaust of the 20th century. But the reason I bring this up is to remember, through most of the career of anti-Jewish hatred and violence, anti-Jewish bigotry was always conditional. Through most of the Middle Ages, the anti-Jew would say, I'm against what Jews believe, but I'm not against the Jews personally. If they would just stop believing what they believed, they could be safe. They would just convert to whatever the dominant majority religion was. They could be for, this is nothing personal. It's nothing against them as human beings. It's against what they think. So it's quite an aberrational moment that the hatred went to the point where there is nothing the Jew could do to escape the hatred. That was the innovation of anti-Semitism.
Wasn't the Nazi rule that if you had one Jewish grandparent, that was enough?
Right. The Nuremberg Laws of 1935. It was an innovation to say there was nothing the Jew could do to escape hatred. Through most of the period in which Jews were murdered and killed and burned and exiled, there was something they could do. But mm-hmm. that didn't make it any more tolerable. Because what Jewish people said is, you know, we'd like not only not to be massacred, but we'd like to be not to be massacred while remaining who we are. We'd like to have the right to exist as ourselves, to believe as we wish, to be different. And so the modern anti-Zionist is not an anti-Semite. I mean, again, you can escape. You can, you know, if you'll repudiate your people and repudiate your group, then you're welcome, in the same way that the Inquisition said you were welcome if you repudiated your people. It's a throwback to that older form of anti-Semitism, which said the problem is what the Jew believes, not what the Jew is. But you know what? That's not an improvement. It's just a difference. And so what I would say is, yeah, it's true. You can be an anti-Zionist without being an anti-Semite in the biological eliminationist way where there's nothing the Jew can do. But can you be an anti-Zionist while respecting Jews as Jews? I would say to that, no, you can't. because, look, we just finished the first Seder of Passover, the first night of Passover, which ends with the words, next year in Jerusalem. The attachment of the Jews to the land of Israel is integral to the Jewish faith. You cannot eliminate that attachment without eliminating Judaism. And as has been proven again and again, you can't eliminate Judaism without eliminating Jewish people.
Can you think of examples of people who have been critical of Israel's policies and have been labeled anti-Semites for criticizing Israeli government policies?
Well, it depends what you mean, but there's a lot of wiggle room here. You know, I don't think they mean Israel's land use rules in Tel Aviv are too strict. When they say, I want to criticize Israel, I mean, there are lots of policies.
Well, they say Israel has been genocidal in Gaza.
Right. Okay. So there are not people go around the world saying, you know, I have a lot of thoughts about the way Peru regulates its dairy market. And I have a lot of criticisms. I have a lot of criticisms of Peruvian policy, or, you know, the German approach to federalism seems to me too decentralized. I have criticisms of that. When people are saying, I want the right to criticize Israel, they're not actually saying, I'm fascinated by the details of governance, and I want to go into what is wrong with Israel's details of governance. They say, I want to create libels against the Jewish state that uniquely apply.
Well, I'm going to stop you right there, because I can imagine somebody saying, now, hold on. People were critical of the old South African regime, and it wasn't about their, you know, dairy rules or anything. It was because they were practicing apartheid,
right,
and people felt, you know, angry and morally outraged by this, and they criticized the government. So they're saying it's the same with Israel.
Well, okay, but understand where that goes. They were saying, yes, we're criticizing, but what their goal was not to reform South Africa and to say, let's have, their goal was to end the existence of the South African state as it was, which was in that case a valid project. When they say, I want to, these are not limited. I'm sure it's true that there are people of limited criticisms. I think many of the people in the Biden administration during the early days of the October 7th war said Israel would do better if it had a policy of punishing Hamas that was much more specifically counter-terrorist, that dealt with leadership. And those kinds of highly grained, highly informed disputes, those do exist. And there are many other kinds of, again, high level, highly detailed, highly grained criticisms of very specific things that Israel does. When they do checkpoints to screen people out, they should have a more permissive standard of screening. Such things do exist. But most of those who want to say the phrase, I want to criticize the policies of the Israeli state, mean I want to criticize the policies that make the Israeli state a state. I'm not looking for reforms. I'm not looking for changes in highly specific, highly detailed, highly informed particulars. My grievance is Israel should not exist as a state for the Jews. That was a crime. That was a mistake. And I want to undo that mistake one way or another, because I have this rainbow flag, candy floss vision of what happens to the people who live in Israel the day the Israeli state ceases to exist.
So you raised a really interesting point about the nature of this criticism is so often that Israel's very existence as a Jewish state is itself illegitimate. And therefore, Israel, I believe, is the only country on earth whose existence is open, considered debatable, right? Yeah. And that should there be a Jewish state? Should there not? I heard somebody once say, you know, a couple considering whether to have another child might consider the pros and cons and discuss, can we afford it, whatever? Do we want to increase our family? Once the child is born, though, you can't have a debate about whether the child should exist or not. So that's over now. Yes. And but not in the case of Israel. And by the way, you know, you can't say it's because Israel is a creation of the United Nations. It's relatively new and all of these other countries are old. No, there are like 50 countries in the United Nations that are younger than Israel.
The state of Bangladesh was created in 1971.
Pakistan is the same age as Israel. Yeah,
exactly.
And so it's not that. And so that strikes people like us as anti-Semitic, that the only country in the world that is whose existence and right to be on the planet is considered debatable is the Jewish state.
And there's a point about that that just also the craziness of this. I'm sure I'm improving the story in memory. But there was a famous writer in 19th century America named Margaret Fuller. She was a poet. She was a essayist. She was a great lecturer. She was a very, very charismatic person. She was also very beautiful. And one of the things she did that just enthralled her friends, Emerson, Hawthorne, and people like that, was she would stand on a stage and throw up her very shapely arms into the air and with her hair flowing declaim, "I accept the universe." Everybody in 19th century Boston loved this, have made a big impression. And the story appeared in letters and newspapers and reported, and word of this performance got back to Thomas Carlyle in England. And Thomas Carlyle was famously a stringent, kind of bitter writer. And he replied, "She accepts the universe? By God, she had better." So, yes. So this whole debate about whether Israel should exist. So Israel right now is a nuclear armed state, flying 200 fighter jets over Iran, which until now had been thought of as the single most powerful state in the entire West Asian region. And there are people who are saying to people who do have, and there are particular grievances against Israel, and there are questions of equal rights and the standing of the Arab population. And there are people who are saying, you know what? You don't have to accept the universe. You don't have to. You can just continue this delusion. You can continue the violence and nonstop war that has gotten the enemies of Israel absolutely nowhere in the 100 years that they've been trying to eliminate, first the pre-state and then the state. Or you can say, you know what, maybe you'd better accept the universe. And this whole debate over the existence of Israel obviously does terrible harm to Israel because it validates attempted annihilation of the state. It does harm to diaspora Jewish communities because, especially since 2025, anti-Israel people who realize Israel is too powerful to attack have concentrated their violence instead against diaspora Jewish communities that are softer targets. And there is an intensifying tempo of harassment, intimidation, and now outright violence and even mass murder against diaspora communities. But you could say that the people most harmed by the non-acceptance are the people on the other side of this debate who are refusing to accept a universe that is big and heavy.
So one thing that they argue, and we just discussed, is, you know, well, Israel is new and therefore, you know, we can debate its existence. The other thing they will say is Israel is committing atrocities and Israel is now a Nazi-like regime that is doing awful things. And therefore it has forfeited our sympathy and its right to exist. So how do you respond to that?
Well, I once got interested in the project of saying, who is the first prominent person to begin to say, Israel, which was once good, has become bad, wicked, and Nazi-like? When did that start? And I've traced it to people like the once famous historian Arnold Toynbee back in the 1950s. I mean, from the beginning of the state, that people have accused Israel of Nazi-like atrocities because look, the memory of the actual Nazi atrocities is a very difficult thing for people who participate in Western civilization to bear. I mean, here it was, in many ways, the most culturally advanced nation in the entire Western world, the most technologically advanced, and all of these seemingly ancient hatreds bubbled out in this program of industrial slaughter. It made everyone who had milder versions of these prejudices feel bad about having the prejudices. There is the joke about the Prussian officer who took part in the assassination attempt against Adolf Hitler because he said, I was fighting to ensure that a gentleman could be an anti-Semite again. it has never not been true. And so, and it's never specific. The United Nations passed a resolution condemning Israel for violating Argentine sovereignty by abducting Adolf Eichmann in 1961 to stand trial in Israel. Toynbee was accusing Israel of being no better than the Nazis in the 1950s and maybe even earlier. When you start surveying opinion in Europe to say, are you sick and tired of hearing about the Holocaust? Europeans are sick and tired of hearing about the Holocaust sometime by the spring of 1946.
That's true.
When someone has a criticism of you that begins at the moment of your existence and remains in place regardless of facts and changing circumstances, and when they keep changing the date, say, well, I used to like you, now I hate you. Well, when was the point at which you slighted me? Well, it was 1967, and then we go look it up. No, you hated me then. At some point, you said, I don't think this is a good faith point. And of course—
Well, but of course, the views of Israel have definitely plummeted. Israel's standing in the world and polling and so on has suffered greatly. Part of this is just deeply ironic, considering that Israel just suffered the worst atrocity since the Holocaust in the October 7th attacks. But it is true that the perception that Israel is doing evil things that has yeah. been out there on TikTok and all the rest has affected people, no?
I'm sure that's true. I think it's difficult, more difficult to say than both people on any side of this debate want to acknowledge. Because first, I think Jews and people who are sympathetic to the Israeli cause want to remember a better past. They want to say there was a time when things were better. If your memory runs back, you say, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, it's important to remember when people have this idea, for example, that there's a strong U.S.-Israel relationship that's now in jeopardy, that for the first near 20 years of the existence of the state, the United States had an arms embargo against Israel. Yeah. President Kennedy was the first president to sell arms to Israel. President Nixon was the first president to give arms to Israel. Presidents didn't tend to visit Israel. I'm going to forget who was the first, but the list of Ronald Reagan never did. Jimmy Carter never did. I think Richard Nixon did. And the relationship was quite cool until really the end of the Cold War. So the intimacy with Israel is much more a post 1990 phenomenon than it was something that was true in the hallowed days of Harry Truman. I think there's also a tendency to, some of the recent polling I have some doubts about. There's a poll, for example, that's gotten a lot of attention that asked, who do you sympathize with more, Israel or the mm-hmm. Palestinians? Mm-hmm. And one of the things people who do a lot of polling tell me is you have to, when you hear a question, think not just how did I hear that, but how do the people who heard the question hear it? So sympathize someone may interpret that as whose side are you on? But they could also interpret it to mean who do you have more pity for?
Yeah, that's possible.
So we have to be careful with a lot of the polling. And anyway, the central Zionist idea, and in this respect, I'm very much in the Zionist tradition, is one of the things that is sometimes said by people who point to these numbers is it's dangerous for Israel when people are mad at it. And that's, of course, true. I mean, Israel is a highly dependent, only 10 million people. It's highly dependent. It has trading relationships. It needs its neighbors. It needs Europe. It needs the United States. But it's also true that the core idea behind Zionism is Jewish survival should not depend on Jewish popularity. That is a bad gamble. And to say, if only people liked you more, you'd be safe. Well, that puts your survival at the mercy of others. And the whole Israeli project was one of survival, that survival should be much more a matter of self-reliance. And so when people say Israel should refrain from doing this thing or that thing, it needs to do for its security. And not everything they do is in every opinion necessary, but should refrain from doing things necessary to its security to obtain some good opinion in some poll somewhere. Put it this way, for a lot of people, especially younger people, this all the traumas that gave birth to the feelings I'm talking about may seem very far away. But I don't know. Let me put this in a personal way. So I was born in 1960. And when I was growing up, World War II seemed like the Hundred Years' War, just something so far away, so past. And it took me a long time to absorb, to put together. I knew all these things were to put together. My father was born in Toronto. I was born in Toronto, Canada in 1960. My father was born in Toronto, Canada in 1931. His parents came from Poland to Canada in 1930. My grandfather was born in 1904, my grandmother about the same time. They didn't come for any big reason. They didn't have outrage. Just the economy had collapsed. They had relatives in Canada. They were able to come. They were looking for work. Had they made a different choice, my father would have been murdered about the time of his 10th or 11th or 12th birthday. As were all of his cousins. And so that seemed very far away. But as you get older, you realize it's not so far away. And the kind of traumas and memories that it gave birth to. And the Holocaust, of course, is the most climactic in the series. But through the 19th century in Russia, Romania, and in the other lands of the Russian Empire, nothing as industrial as the Holocaust took place, but murders of thousands and tens of thousands of people. Those are routine features of life. And the Jewish state exists to say there has to be a place where Jews can go because it is predictable. that their neighbors will try to murder them
eventually.
And their safety should be found in themselves and not in the sufferance of their neighbors.
Okay, true confessions. I have a lot of things in my closet that were bad purchases, you know, impulse purchases, and they pile up. Of course, I'm old, so my pile's getting really tall of things that I never wear. And so I've been going through it, doing a little spring cleaning and getting rid of the things that I never wear. And you know what I keep reaching for is the things that I got from Quince. The fabrics feel elevated, the fits are thoughtful, and the pricing makes sense. Quince makes beautiful everyday pieces using premium materials like 100% European linen, which is very important as the weather warms up, organic cotton, and super soft denim with styles starting around $50. Their spring pieces are lightweight, breathable, and effortless, the kinds of things you throw on and you look instantly put together. And you will know that you love your Quince things when you keep reaching for the same things over and over, which is what I've been finding. So refresh your spring wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/Mona for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. Go to Quince, that's Quince.com/Mona for free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/Mona for the things in your closet that you will just keep reaching for day after day. Okay, so I hear you. There's a part of me, having absorbed all of these centuries of Jewish oppression and sense of vulnerability, really understands and agrees with the idea that Jews need to rely on themselves and don't, you know, trying always to be liked, is not a good guarantee of Jewish safety. And there is a part of me that sees those Stars of David on F-16 fighters and says, damn right, you know, that's the way it has to be. Okay. But, playing devil's advocate here, it is definitely an arguable case that Netanyahu made a terrible mistake by wedding himself so completely to just one party in the United States. Israel had a policy for years of enjoying bipartisan support. Netanyahu sacrificed all of that to be joined at the hip with Trump. Do you think that there is a price that Israel is paying in terms of disinhibiting left-wing anti-Semitism because of this alliance with Trump and Trumpism?
I think that's for sure right. I mean, it predates Trump. I mean, that Netanyahu made that bet during the Obama days.
Right.
And you can see this escalating because Obama, who was born in 1961, I think, was a president from a different generation. He was not born in the 1940s. And I think one of the things that we are seeing is that the cohort, especially of Americans, but of people elsewhere, who were born between about 1940 and 1960, were a uniquely pro-philo-Semitic group in the history of the world, maybe.
Right.
And as you age out of that population, who were young enough to have been formed by the shock of the revelations after World War II, as you move beyond that, as Israel seems more stable and secure and powerful, there's a shift in sentiment. And Obama, I think this is not an ad hominem point. I think probably had less emotional sympathy with Israel than any of the presidents since the founding of the State of Israel. And so that coolness, and then some of the policies of administration that also informed Netanyahu's bet. But look, Obama's the head of a superpower. And Netanyahu is not. So Netanyahu has to accommodate. And I think he did bet too far. And I think since October 7th, I think Netanyahu failed to give Biden enough credit for the things that Biden was doing for Israel, was too eager to take his chance on Trump, and may have been too reliant on military options, including an Iran war that started dazzlingly successful, but seems to be looking less successful by the day. Or certainly more costly by the day.
Also, he has damaged Israel's image, even with many Jews, by allying himself with really despicable allies of the far right in Israel.
Yeah. Before I go to that, I'm very conscious that I omitted to say something when I was talking about Jewish traumas that needed to be said, which is I was citing the Russian Empire and the Holocaust and my family history. But of course, a majority of the Israeli Jewish population does not come from Europe.
Correct.
A majority of the Jewish population of Israel comes from the Middle East, where they have their own traumas that are less industrially spectacular than the Nazi Holocaust. But Bernard Lewis has a great formula. He said that conditions for Jews under Islam as compared to Christianity, that the conditions were never for the Jews of Islam. The conditions were never as bad at their worst as they were for the Jews of Christianity, but they were never as good at their best as for the Jews under Christianity, because you could live in a liberal state and have equal rights, and that was never possible in the Islamic world. And Jews from places like Iraq, in particular, suffered genocidal treatment at the hands of their neighbors in 1941, and there are many pogroms and attacks and murders that was just, again, the sense of not being able to trust the mercy of their neighbors. So I wanted to bracket this. I meant to say that, and I didn't say it in the proper place. So I'm saying it in an improper place, but that needs to be remembered too. And I think one of the things that a lot of people in anti-Zionist movements in the West have trouble remembering is that an absolute majority of the Jewish population, they trace their ancestry to that zone from Morocco to Iran, not from, as my people do, from north of the Mediterranean.
Right. So on the topic of Netanyahu's alliance with racists and extremists, what about that?
Okay. So I'm not a complete expert on Israeli politics at all, but my understanding is that Netanyahu is a problem, which is that his core group of supporters do not get him to the 61 Knesset seats necessary to form a government. And he has two sets of coalition partners, ultra-nationalists who are not ultra-religious and ultra-religious people who are not ultra-nationalist. And the ultra-nationalists who are not ultra-religious, that's the Ben-Gavir, the Shmotriches, and you can tell them by the tiny kippot they wear. They are highly intolerant, but they are patriotic. They bear arms for the state. They pay taxes to the state. The ultra-religious are not as extremist in their intolerance of Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims as the ultra-nationalists are, but they don't bear arms for the state. And Israel is having a big argument right now about whether the ultra-religious should be conscripted and should see their welfare benefits reduced, because Israel incredibly not only doesn't draft them, but pays that population, which is growing by the day, in enormous sums to do nothing, basically.
Right.
So from a Netanyahu, if your project is to draft the Haredi, you are left, the arithmetic of Israeli politics pushes you into alliance with the ultra-nationalists, who aren't that numerous. But that's the reason why Netanyahu is doing things like this crazy new anti-terrorist death penalty bill. Those are his payments to the ultra-nationalists, not ultra-religious, to agree with him about trying to take some measures against the ultra-religious, not ultra-nationalist. I don't know that any of this is ultimately good politics, and why Israel can't have a coalition of the secular center, I don't know enough to know. And Netanyahu plays a lot of games. He is a survivor. But I think it also has to be said, this is the post-October 7th world, and the people who are criticizing the Israeli response do not come to this debate in every case with clean hands, because 1,200 people were murdered. The majority of them civilians, but the soldiers were taken by surprise and killed off in atrocious ways, including a cousin of mine. People were abducted and held as hostages. Women were mass sexually abused. This was and the documents that have been unearthed from Hamas indicate they hugely exaggerated their chances of success, and they had in mind a kind of genocidal plan of elimination of the state, murder of many people, exile of many people, enslavement of the survivors. So this is a society that has gone through a kind of attack that dwarfs the 9/11 attacks in terms of its existential significance. And if it's responding in ways that look to people in safety excessive, you know, I remember years ago sitting on sitting with friends in Toronto, Canada, where I grew up, and somebody saying, you know, this is the thing that Canadians get, because, you know, in every way you look, there's a lot of Ontario. And then beyond that, there's Manitoba. And then Saskatchewan. And then it's still a long, long way before you hit the Pacific Ocean. And if you drive
south,
it's like
that famous New Yorker cartoon.
Right. And if you drive south, you hit the United States, where everyone speaks English and also eats at the Olive Garden.
Yeah.
And the idea of, you know, that it's a few city blocks away and you're surrounded, you are at the mercy of people who not only dream of massacring you, but actually tried it as recently as October 7th of 2023. That provokes reactions. And so again, you don't have to, not every decision is going to be good.
Let's get into the reaction of the left. And I want to deal with both the left and anti-Semitism and the right. So let us start with the left, because, you know, one of the things you hear a lot is, well, the reason that there is so much anti-Jewish and anti-Israel sentiment right now is because of the awful images that people are getting from Gaza and so on. And you've pointed out in a piece in The Atlantic that many of those images are actually from the Syrian civil war. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of disinformation out there, but even allowing that there are disturbing images, it is significant, it seems to me, and I'd love to hear your views, that in the days immediately following the October 7th massacres, you had members of the Democratic Socialists of America and other left-wing American organizations, and certainly worldwide too. It was in Australia and other places, celebrating the attack and saying, this is what resistance looks like. By any means, what did you think it meant by any means necessary, for example, or globalize the intifada? Do people understand that globalize the intifada means you attack Jews wherever they may be? That's the only meaning that that phrase can possibly have. It's an invitation to targeting Jews worldwide. In any event, I cite this because it shows that there was already this predisposition to excuse atrocities against Jews.
There is a long tradition on the active left, and there are a lot of people with soft left views and a lot of people with sort of casual left views, but on the active left, of looking for a paradise on earth, a promise that that the dreams of socialism can be achieved. And for a while, that promise was the Soviet Union. But then the Soviet Union was exposed as bureaucratic and boring. And so in the post-1945 era, a lot of the people who held this wish for a utopia on earth transferred those hopes to one or another revolutionary movement in what used to be called the Third World, in the post-colonial world. And they would make fetishes of the Viet Cong and the Cuban Revolution. And all those revolutions in their turn proved disappointing. Either like Cuba, they bogged down into Soviet-style bureaucracy, or like the Vietnam Revolution, they came to power and realized socialism is stupid, actually. We're going to change that.
and they're a very thriving capitalist country now.
We don't love democracy. We don't like the risk of losing power. But the whole idea of those farmer collectives, forget that. That's just dumb. A lot of the desire for utopia said, we don't like, I forget now which German philosopher is popularize the difference between being and becoming. We don't like revolutions that are in being, but we love revolutions that are becoming. And we love that moment, that the pit fist in the air, the Kalashnikov in the air, the scarf around the face, and the thrill of the Palestinian movement is here is a revolutionary movement that always loses. You never have to worry about them creating a dreary, boring Cuban-style state because they always lose. And so you can put all your wish for a more romantic kind of politics into them. And then you can tap into deeper DNA, which is anti-Semitism has always flourished on the left as well as on the right. It's just historically not valid to say this is a right-wing phenomenon. It's especially in the Marxist tradition, it's there from the beginning. Marx wrote his violently anti-Semitic on the Jewish question before he wrote either the Communist Manifesto or Das Kapital. Mm-hmm. And so it's been present because look, socialism has, and communism are universalist movements. And like the Christian faith of the pre-anti-Semitic forms of Jew hatred. Jews are a Jews are relentlessly, stubbornly particularist people.
Yeah.
They just don't want your universal. Some do. Some defect. They're always there. Have always been Jewish communists, and partly because of the burdens of Jewish particularity, maybe communism has been disproportionately attractive to Jews. There are Jews who want out and want to sink themselves in the universal, and so they've been attracted to communism before, and they're now. I think those are the people who are now in Jewish anti-Zionism are people who would have been communists if they'd been older, because they want out from the particularity of the Jewish existence and all the threats and discomfort and obligations that that imposes. But there is this revolutionary fantasy, and I think this is how these politics are bad. If you're a grown up of the left, you would want to say, how does a socialist society or a social democratic society, how does it work? How does it maintain a material standard of living? How does it keep the lights on? How does it make the waterworks work? How does it keep the trams going? But you're always dealing with the DSA tradition that says those questions are depressing and boring and not what we're in politics to do. We're in politics to overturn things, not to build things. And we love revolutionary movements and especially third world movements. I think I'm going to mangle this quote a little bit, but there's a quote of John Maynard Keynes where in the 1930s, a friend writes to him about his son going to visit the Soviet Union, and he's hoping the son will come back cured of his communist illusions. And Keynes writes back wisely, "When your son comes back from Bolshevism and goes through Bolshevism and finds it dreadfully uncomfortable, that won't change anything. That's the whole point. That's what he finds attractive about it, is if he wanted comfort, he would be a British liberal."
So there are a lot of people on the left who have this romantic idea about the permanent revolution, as you say. But isn't there another element there too? There's just a true hatred of Jews. So what causes someone, however, idealistic a revolutionary they may be, to tear down posters of Jewish children hostages?
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that something a little darker than just I'm a revolutionary?
Yeah. Look, anti-Semitism has flourished in revolutionary movements of the left. It flourished in the Soviet Union. As I said, I think it's present in the DNA of Marxism from the beginning. And as Marxism has had this, it's not the only leftist tradition, but it's the single most important, I think. And certainly the style and affect. And Marxism has anti-Semitism in its DNA from Marx's own peculiar upbringing. I think there's something else that is going on too throughout the Western world, which is left-wing social democratic parties that promise materially better conditions have been extremely successful, more in Europe than in North America, but successful everywhere. That when you say our vision of leftism is something where there are better pensions and more unemployment insurance and subsidies for this for daycare centers, and that is a real vote winner, at least so long as there's money to pay for it. But there are more revolutionary traditions that are not vote winners. And so in recent times, a lot of them have said there's been this large Islamic immigration, large immigration from the Muslim world to the West, which has other kinds of grievances against Jews that are not exactly left-wing grievances, that are nationalist and religious. And not every person from that world, many people leave that world to leave all that stuff behind them and to embrace their new homelands. And probably most, so I think in North America, it's probably true that most people come from the Middle East are saying good riddance, want no more of that. But in Europe, where the geography is a little more favorable, there are many people come and bring those attitudes with them. And that creates a pool of voting strength. And so you see these attempts to forge red-green alliances. And I think the DSA in the United States is trying to do that. In America, I think it's especially bad politics. In Europe and in England, it's not necessarily such bad politics, but here it really is. And it's just bad advice. You see this with this whole Hassan Piker business on the political left. It is often presented as if Hassan Piker is, maybe he's unpleasant, maybe he's radioactive, but at least he brings some important new pool of support.
Oh, and they say he could be our Joe Rogan, say some enthusiasts.
Yeah. Even if that were true, politics is not just a matter of scooping up things and putting them in a bag, because every time you scoop up something, you lose something. And it's a matter of trade-offs. And so it's true. There are people who get energized when they hear someone say the United States deserve 9/11, but you have to net that out.
Let's be clear. That's what Hassan Piker has said.
You have to, You have to net that out and say, okay, for every one vote we gain with a yay 9/11 message, how many votes do we lose? And it's probably not a one-to-one ratio. And so again, in Britain, in Europe, the math may be a little different. In the United States, the DSA approach, and it just means, and every moment you're talking about, every moment you're saying we are making anti-Zionism message one, you're discovering that you are not making pensions message one.
So one of the things that you've written is that the right has been at least making some token efforts, maybe not so token efforts, to grapple with the anti-Semitism that's been unleashed, and we'll come to that. The left, arguably, not so much. Speaking of Hassan Piker, who, in addition to cheering on 9/11 or saying that the U.S. deserved it, let's see, he has also said there's a lot we can learn from the Chinese Communist Party. He said that Hamas is 1,000 times better than the Israeli state. He has said that Orthodox Jews are inbred. He has dismissed the mass rape of Jewish and Israeli women by Hamas, etc. And yet, you've got Bernie Sanders, who has gone on his program. And there's a big debate now because Third Way is attempting to anathematize Hassan Piker and is urging that he not be included in the big tent. And this has caused a lot of controversy on within the Democratic Party.
Well, the Democratic Party, one of the reasons I think this debate exists is because of the gathering collapse of Republican support. The Democratic Party can afford, or there are people in the Democratic Party who may believe they can afford to be less strategic about their approach to politics. There's an old saying in politics that it's more important to control the party than to win the election. And so oftentimes you will sacrifice, that people who have strong programmatic views are willing to sacrifice elections in order to gain their factional goals. I think some of that has always gone on with the Democratic left, which is a Democratic Party that tilts to the left is less electable than one that tilts to the right, but a Democratic Party that tilts to that is more electable will exclude the left, and the left hates that. Mm-hmm. So there's some of that that is going on. And right now, because this is a little bit more, there's more elbow room in this debate with the Republican Party numbers shrinking as they do. And because the moderate Democrat figures that we see are kind of uninspiring as compared to those of the 1990s. In the early 1990s, Democrats had lost the elections of 1980, 84, and 88, where they thought they would be competitive in 88. They had never come to grips with the Reagan phenomenon, and they were, by the early 1990s, really excited to say, let's find people who can reach out to new sectors of the economy and say, you know what, not every Democrat is going to build cars for a living or build steel. That in these suburban office parks, there are a lot of potential Democrats, but they have more moderate politics. And so Bill Clinton and Al Gore and people like that reached out to them, who are young and dynamic and good looking. And so right now the Democrats who say, we need to remember that most people are not excited by the stuff that makes the activists, they look old. That's why this Maine Senate race is so symbolic, is that the person who's saying the sensible things, Governor Janet Mills, is no one is excited about her, and you can understand why not. And Graham Platner, some people, who's the challenger, some people are excited by him, although he's put on record all kinds of unacceptable things that may be expensive in a general election. So until Democratic moderation can find some way to be a little bit more glamorous, there's going to be a lot of energy on the side of people who are bringing really bad advice to the Democratic Party.
Okay, let's turn now to the people on the right we are living in an era where Candace Owens, who is, as far as I can tell, certifiably insane, has 30 million followers on a combination of YouTube, Twitter, all the rest of it, who circulates the hoariest anti-Semitic lies, the blood libel. She called the facts about Joseph Mengele, the famous Nazi doctor who performed grotesque experiments on living human beings in the Holocaust. She calls this bizarre propaganda. She said Stalin was part of a Jewish cabal, on and on. I mean, and if you know anything, if people know anything about Candace Owens, you know that she is the one who believes that and is being sued for alleging that Emmanuel Macron's wife is actually a man, et cetera, et cetera. So she is out there, but she has a huge following. And my colleague, Sarah Longwell, who does focus groups and listens to voters all the time, has commented that her name comes up all the time where people say, well, I don't agree with everything she says, but she sure gets me thinking. Okay.
Yeah.
And then of course there's Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
And so, and that's just scratching the surface of the levels of anti-Semitism, good old fashioned Nazi style anti-Semitism that we're seeing on the right. How do you compare the two?
Well, it is a little, the left-wing version, remembering the frame with which I started, medieval anti-Judaism and 19th century anti-Semitism. The point to me, 19th century anti-Semitism was you couldn't escape, whereas medieval anti-Judaism, you could escape if you just surrendered your identity. And so left-wing anti-
And we're baptized.
Exactly. Left-wing anti-Judaism is of the medieval kind. If you just You don't have to change your name. You don't have to stop eating babka. You don't have to stop enjoying Jerry Seinfeld, but you just have to remove anything that makes you different from anybody else, and then you can be accepted. That's the and some people find that, as I said, a very attractive offer. So it's like medieval anti-Judaism. What Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens are offering is much more like 19th century anti-Semitism. It is just ineradicable. There's a conspiracy, and the more you deny it, the more you prove you're part of it. And both of them have deep roots, ideological, historical. I think there's that right-wing anti-Semitism is especially a product of algorithmic forcing. Because can it be true that more people are watching Candace Owens than watch Walter Cronkite at the peak of his appeal? Can that be true? When you say that figure 30 million, is it real? And what does it describe? How many of the 30 million, how many actual human beings are watching this, and how many of them are actually American human beings, and how many of them are bots, and how many of them are repeat performances?
Okay, that's why I mentioned the focus groups, because you know, you can debate whether the numbers are what they are claimed, but her influence is definitely noticeable when you talk to voters.
I don't mean to deny that, not to say these things are not big, but the forcing mechanism is that people feel, a lot of people get scared who, if they were not scared, would discover there was actually nothing to be scared of. Now, again, I think with the right-wing anti-Semitism, I think it falls in many ways on receptive ears. I think there's an appetite for it. Because a lot of the modern right is driven by the feelings of a certain kind of person, especially younger people, especially younger male people, that there's something that they were entitled to have that's been taken away from them. And who took it? The thing that's been taken away from them in many cases, women. They want the women, but they can't, and they blame the women. But in the end, they don't have enough respect for women to believe, well, the women absented themselves. If they were, they could believe in more abstract processes like capitalism or modernity or, if they were that abstract, they'd be on the left, not on the right. The right wants personal villains. They may be racist, but racism is a prejudice of contempt. At some level, you can't believe that people who you regard as your inferiors could have taken it away from you. So your system of blame needs someone who is, you acknowledge, is competent and capable, but also malevolent and also alien. And that role, that's what the Jews are custom made for. That there they are, these secret masterminds, and they're the reason you don't have a girlfriend.
And by the way, it's bizarre that one of the articles of faith of these people, the kinds who are carrying the torches in Charlottesville and elsewhere, and Tucker Carlson has hit this theme many times, the great replacement theory, which is that the Jews are masterminding the imposition of these huge numbers of immigrants, including Muslim immigrants, into the United States. I mean, you have to sort of
taking away who are the reason you don't have a girlfriend.
Yeah, for sure. But also the idea that the Jews would be importing Muslims who are not friendly to Jews. I don't know, just a little illogical.
Look, none of this makes a lot of sense. And it's also falsified by the test of experience, which is any young man who doesn't have a girlfriend who seriously wants one. If you just did two experiments, let's take 100 young men who want a girlfriend who don't have one and divide them into two populations. And population number one starts bathing regularly and getting better haircuts and working out and dressing better and holding down stable jobs and talking to women, and understanding that the first two will say no, but the third will say yes. And say, what is their success rate versus what is the success rate of people who watch Nicholas Fuentes and fulminate and send him money? What is their success rate? And they see that get a bath, work out, dress nicely, talk to girls. That works a lot better than anti-Semitic paranoia, but it does require some effort on your part.
Well, I do think there's a deeper story there about what's happened to men in our culture. And there has been a little bit too much denigration of the male sex.
I'm all for that, but at some level, as my daughters say, when you talk to them about the problems you're having, why is this my fault? I'm dressing nicely. I'm going to the gym. If you speak to me politely, I will answer you. I am interested in exploring whether you might be a mate for me. So you won't do any of those things. How am I to blame? And then even more and Rabbi Akiva over there, what did he do? Yeah. Get a haircut, put on some nicer clothes, talk to a girl and leave Rabbi Akiva out of it.
But, they go online and instead of being told to brush their teeth and use deodorant and comb their hair, they get told to, smash their face with hammers and be aggressive and cruel because that's what women like.
Yeah. I think this is one of my deepest fears about our contemporary culture, which is one of the reasons that artificial intelligence is seems to be winning the race so much of the time is that because natural stupidity seems also to be an accelerating force. Really hitting your face with a hammer? You think that's going? How do you? In my day, hitting your face was the definition of self-harming stupidity. I mean, how did you
Who among us hasn't hit our face with a hammer in an attempt to look good? Oh, right. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about. Mamdani, you've gotten into, some controversy online because you've been critical of him. And you said, their anti-Semites are terrible, but our anti-Semites are bringing new enthusiasm. So, look, I think Mamdani, giving him full credit, he's great at promising a lot of things to people. Yeah. All credit to him. He's friendly. He has a nice smile. But he is associated, and here's the here's the thing I want people to understand. I mean, at least speaking now only for myself, I'm perfectly willing to give him a chance and hope that he will moderate as mayor of New York. After all, it is still a very a city with a very large Jewish population, and I hope he will try to make amends. He has been associated with really hateful anti-Semitism. And people have, in my judgment, given that a complete pass. But now, what do you think?
I have two things I would say to that. The first is politics is being a candidate for office is very difficult. A lot of sacrifices. And a lot of the time it seems very unpromising. So politicians need a reason to get out of bed in the morning and go do the difficult things they're asked to do. They have to do. Why? What is the driving force? It's often psychic. Sometimes it's ideological. But what's the and you look at the career of Mamdani, it's pretty obvious. The thing that gets him out of bed in the morning is not government-owned grocery stores. That was a very late addition to his repertoire. It's not housing, about which his views seem to change with the weather. The thing that made him into politics was his anti-Israel. And that's the driver. Now, there as mayor of New York, there's a fairly limited scope. But when you say he may moderate, it's also possible that as the rest of his program grinds into failure, because a lot of his program is extremely unrealistic and predicated on a New York economy, because he's not interested in those issues, that the idea that you are spending money or you plan to spend money that is created by a financial industry anchored in New York that no longer – first, the financial industry is going to be – going through revolutions and is about to become a lot less lucrative. And second, it has no reason to be anchored in New York anymore. So that is the thing that is underpinning all of your plans for how you want to redistribute wealth, the wealth you want is first not going to exist in such numbers, and second may move to Miami. So what happens when the program doesn't work? Well, maybe you turn to the center and try to be a good government liberal Democrat and live within your means and balance the books, or you incite. You need a villain. So we'll see. But I'm guessing it's at least as likely that when he makes his bid at the core of his appeal for a second term, for lack of accomplishments, there is going to be an uptick in incitement, because that is the thing that is going to get the core group that he needs to get excited to stay excited. But we'll see. But we're already operating in terrain of negotiating with things that were, maybe it's a beautiful new world where the president of Ukraine is Jewish and the mayor of New York
is Hamas adjacent.
Yeah. I could have told my grandfather the day will come when the Passover greeting from the president of Ukraine is more heartfelt and culturally literate than the Passover greeting from the mayor of New York. Yeah. Only in America, I think he would have said. Yeah.
All right. Finally, I just want to share a fear of mine. I wrote a column recently saying that I was, I am an Iran hardliner, but that I cannot support this war because I think it is, asking Donald Trump to execute properly is like, being stranded by the side of the road and accepting a ride from a drunk driver. It's not going to end well. And what it's already not ending well. So specifically about the anti-Semitism angle, I mean, it's terrible for the world. It is terrible for the U.S. It's terrible for our reputation, for a million things, for the economy. It's bad in so many ways. But one aspect that I just want to focus on with you, since we are talking about anti-Semitism, is picking up on a theme from Nick Catoggio, who writes a great newsletter. He said, because Trump can never be wrong, because Trump can never be blamed for anything, it must always be someone else's fault. The question is, if this war goes sideways, which arguably it already is, isn't it obvious that Israel is going to take the blame, and that people in the Republican coalition, of course, Democratic coalition is almost universally against this war, but that people in the Republican coalition who until now have been fairly well inclined toward Israel will sour on Israel and blame Israel for having gotten us into this box canyon?
Well, the scenario you describe is not a hypothetical one. We have already seen talkers like Megyn Kelly suggesting that Trump, feeble-minded old man that he was in manipulating the war by Benjamin Netanyahu. You can see why that line of excuse wouldn't appeal to Trump or those around him, but it has some carrying power. But even more, imagine that this war does continue for some time, and that Republicans take heavy losses in 2026 because of the war and the economic dislocations. And look, the economy wasn't good before the war. What does J.D. Vance do? He's never been emotionally close to Israel. He's highly aligned with people who are borderline anti-Semitic or outright anti-Semitic. And he will see that the Iran war is his big problem in 2028. And he was probably never for it. Does he campaign as somebody who is, as the New York Times put it the other day, J-pilled, Jewish-pilled? And does he bring these right-wing anti-Semitic tendencies into the very center of presidential nomination politics on the Republican side? You can see that's going to be very appealing to him. Because otherwise, what does he say about Iran for 2028?
But wouldn't it seem disloyal to Trump, and wouldn't that be the kiss of death in the Republican Party?
By 2028, being disloyal to Trump may not be the kiss of death, and I don't think J.D. Vance has any trouble being disloyal to anybody.
No, I understand that he doesn't as a matter of character, but it could matter politically for him. I don't know. Okay. Well, it is remains to be seen. But David, thank you so much for shedding light on a difficult subject as only you can.
Well, I don't want to end on this too much of a downer of a note, because what I want to say is, You know, sometimes we have to be reminded of what we care about. And sometimes adversity is the thing that reminds us. And if you're Jewish, the wave of anti-Semitism since October 7th, 2023 is a way of reminding you of why your tradition, your community is precious to you. And if you're not Jewish, the wave of anti-Semitism is a reminder of why a liberal society and a tolerant society is precious to you. And a way to rediscover as well that the health and vitality of a free society is to a great extent measured by how it treats minorities. And Jews are not the only minority who measure the health, the status of women, the place of homosexuals, that those are also
immigrants.
But for a long time in the society, standard societies of the West, it's probably the longest continuing test. And societies where the Jews have fared well have been free societies. And so we're all in this together, and we're all challenged together, and let's have the confidence to believe that we'll all overcome together.
Words live by. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.